Okay, Midori.
Good afternoon. My name is Midori, and welcome to the Brown Backlands Lecture Series this season. And we've been focusing on long-term projects. And today we have a wonderful guest, Robin Kang. And she has been engaged in this amazing project, which is called Dining in Refugee Camps, which was based on her project in 2009 when she went to Tindo camp in, is that the
in Algeria. Yeah.
Algeria. And she collected the recipes by collaborating with the woman in Algerian refugee camp. And those are the Swahili people. They are the indigenous people in North Africa, and then made this, published this cookbook. And the project evolved from there, and it's still going on, and
yeah.
It's really like developing in many different predictable ways. Robin, before this project, she started as a gallery artist in a commercial gallery, but she was not very satisfied, and she started exploring more possibilities by collaborating with many different people. She's a feminist artist, and she started looking into like women's very like strong social roles and so on. And she curated many exhibitions and published a lot of books, and one of them, which I think is really like, you know, important, is Time Capsule. And some of the books are for on sale here.
That would be great.
Okay. Okay. And please welcome Robin Kang.
Thank you, everybody, for coming, and thank you, Midori, for inviting me to do this. And I'm just going to start in. I'm going to talk, as Midori said, about the genesis of this project, which was in Western Sahara. Well, it was actually in Algeria, where two-thirds of the population of Western Sahara live. And I went to the refugee camps where they've been living for 38 years. And I lived and cooked with the women as a way of finding out where this country is and who these people are and how they continue to live in these circumstances. So I went as a part of an arts and human rights festival. It was called Arte Fariti, that came out of Spain. And the thing is that the reason that Spain has a relationship with Western Sahara is because it used to be a Spanish colony, and it was called Spanish Sahara. And it's this very dark one right here. There. See? Okay. And so it has ties to Spain and the Canary Islands. And in 1880, it was made a colony, so the indigenous people were working with the Spanish people. It was a pretty affable relationship. And then in 1975, when Franco was dying, he was going to give the country back to the people of Western Sahara. And right then, Morocco came and occupied the country. And they still have occupied much of the country. Today, this is a close-up of Western Sahara. And this is a huge wall, which is the largest mined military defense wall in the world. And it separates the area that's controlled by Morocco, which is this area, from the rest of the country, which is called the Liberated Territories. And this, in Algeria, is where the camps are. So two-thirds of the population have been living here, waiting to go back and repopulate, repatriate their land. And this wall was built by the Americans, the French, and with Israeli help. And ever since it was built, there was no more fighting between the Polisario, which is the military section or faction from Western Sahara, and against the Moroccans, because they can't penetrate the wall. So there was a UN ceasefire that was called. And with the promise that there would be a referendum where the indigenous people, the Suari people, would be able to vote if they wanted to be incorporated into Morocco, which I have no idea why they would want that, or if they want to be independent. And they've been waiting since 1990 for this vote to come up in the UN, and it's been stalemated ever since, and they're still waiting. So I went to the refugee camps, and you know, when I don't know, when I thought of refugee camps, I didn't think of these sprawling cities. This is in the hottest part of the Sahara Desert called the Hamada. It's 120 degrees during the day, and all of the buildings are built out of the sand that is actually on the ground, and it's mixed with water, and the bricks are dried, and then they make these houses. And now they're big family compounds, and there are five different refugee camps. And this is a picture of February 27, which is named after the day in 1976 that the women established the refugee camps. And I'll talk more about that. But so the first part of a trip with Artie Fariti was 2 weeks where we'd go around and stay in the different camps, and then we would have these workshops. And there were a lot of artists from Spain. I was the first artist from America to be a part of this festival. But now there have been more. And the whole idea of the festival is to learn about the people and then to make their struggle more visible to a global audience. So I just wanted to show this project. This is by my friend Alonso Hill. He is from Sevilla, and he started this and has been doing it 6 years. And actually, my jacket on the back is one of the pieces he did. But we all go into the different towns, and then we say to the people, what is it that you want to say? And so it'll be freedom or change or these different images, a piece of peaceful images. And these people have decided to politically adopt peace as their way in every aspect of their life. And so art is a peaceful weapon for them to arm people with words about them, about their lives. And so these are the little kids who are in the town, and they just take their T-shirts off, and we're all in a line screening them. And then in the evenings, we would have these fashion shows. And these are the military guys. So they... all the men, when they get to a certain age, they still are practicing for the military, even though there's been peace since 1990. But the cool thing is, here they are wearing these combat outfits with the signs of peace on them. I just want to show that. So the camps are all up here, and then we travel down here to Tifariti, and this whole area, most people won't live there because of the mines that are in the ground. There's I think like 10 million mines that are seated along the wall. So the people who have stayed there, they want to stay there because that's their country, Western Sahara. Algeria is not their country. But they can't really because they're nomadic people, and they used to follow the stars and the clouds to find out where water was for their camels. But they can't do that now because the mines travel up through the sand, and their legs get blown off, and it's just very dangerous. And so that's why most of the people are still up in the camps. So this is in the liberated territory, and you can see that the whole landscape is just scarred with the war. That's fuego, ego, fire. So there I am, and what I'm doing at this point while I'm helping with the workshops is I'm hanging out with families, different families, and trying to get into their kitchens and to cook with them as a way of hanging out with the women, making them feel really relaxed in their everyday ritual, which is something that I also do as a way of connecting to them. And so that I could, get the information about who they are through this tradition that really, it sustains their culture. And that's Mahayar, and this is one of the family compounds. It usually has a tent in the middle, and that's, a traditional from Nomadic Times, and it is the center of social and family life. But they're sitting outside, and she's making couscous and showing me how to do that with her family. And that's, okay, so Mahayir's in black, and then that's her two daughters, and her aunt is there, and their granddaughter is there. So these families, what you start to see is there are very few men hanging around. Really, the women, what happened was when the bombs were dropping from Morocco, the men stayed to defend their land, and the women just grabbed the little kids and the older people and started heading across the desert. And when they reached Algeria, they had nothing. So what they did is they took off their melfas, which is what they call their the dress, and they made the very first tents. And then after they made the tents, they made a school system. And here's the schools here. The women teach all the schools. There's 99% literacy in the camps. And then in 1976, they wrote in their constitution, a constitution in exile, and they gave women equal rights in 1976. Okay, this is Algeria. So what I started to learn is, okay, me being an educated woman from New York, who knew nothing about these people, if I really listened to the way Arabs are being described in our country, it doesn't link up at all to my experience there. And actually, these are super emancipated women. And they have created their society without men, because the men were fighting. And so how do they do that? They have to rely on each other by creating cooperatives. And I just showed this because that's the schools, that's family life, that's social life. And that's the women actually, they build all the houses. They own all the property. And when a man gets married, he takes her name and moves into her house. Okay, so that was my mom in one of the camps. These are her daughters, and three of them were deaf. And what they use the meal, and which is a very long ritual, to, I guess, sate you in a way, and so that you will sit there and you get to know them, and then they'll tell you their history. And so she spoke French, because most people speak Spanish there because it was a colony of Spain, but because it's surrounded by Mauritania and Mali and Morocco, which are all French, former French colonies, and Algeria, sorry, a lot of people speak French. And now, out of necessity, a lot of people speak German, Italian, English, and their own dialect, which is Hassaniya, which is the oldest Arabic dialect, and it's connected to poetry and song, ancient poetry and song, and it's an oral tradition that has not been written down. So they are these amazing storytellers where they're incorporating the horrific details of their lives into these stories that are woven with words that just, enchant you. And so that was my first experience with Leolud. So I'm just going to show you sort of a little bit of the lay of the land in the camps. Everybody, after the women took off their melfas and made tents, well, the UN moved in a couple of years, and everybody gets a UN issue tent, and it looks drab like that on the outside, and that is, a part of the tradition. And then they have built those brick, I guess they're adobe, but they're really sand houses, which is great unless it rains, at which point they completely dissolve. That's the bathroom, which means, okay, no running water. And this was a cool house that I took a picture of because it shows the innovation of the people. Nothing can grow there in the Hamada, nothing. And so these people have to rely on humanitarian aid. And the trucks come in and they bring the food and then they just leave the trucks there and as carcasses. So the people have started to weld them into these houses, which is great for the rain. And the rainy season, I think, is like 4 days or something, but it's torrential. And so people will just move into the tin house. And in one of the houses I was in, there was a big truck container. And when you went inside, there was a disco ball and like all these very cool, fabrics and pillows and music and incense, and they just had made this the warmest space inside of this completely cold container. So, like I said, the sand is salty, nothing can grow, and so water's delivered, and this is one of the houses I stayed at. These huge trucks come, and then they put them in water in the tanks. Well, okay, the tanks are for washing, for cooking your food, for cleaning your house, for every single thing, you know, you're getting from the same source, and you have a limited amount. So if you run out, you just go to the next family compound, and you borrow from them, and it's a reciprocal kind of community in that way. So this is a poster that shows how the women go to get the food when it's dropped as a humanitarian drop. And they are covering their faces, and they do that, which is it's like crazy when you're walking around there because you can't tell who anybody is. But they're all like, hola, Robin, hola. And it's just, I can't tell who they are. But they'll cover their faces if there's a lot of wind and sand, but they're doing it here purposely because they don't want to rely on humanitarian aid. They don't want their pictures of them just picking up food because they would rather grow it, and they'd rather grow it and cultivate it in their own land. And so it's a stance that they're taking. So I made that collage, and it was just out of all of the garbage that is dropped around, but you can see all the different kinds of food that what countries it's coming from. And I got this picture on a corner. I saw, oh, look, America's giving peas. And I took a photo, and someone came out and was really angry at me. They really didn't want me to have that photo. And this one with the fish here, if the people were in their own country, they have all the fish off their coast in the Atlantic Ocean. Actually, Morocco doesn't have it, and Morocco has a lot of fishing contracts with other countries off the coast of Western Sahara, and that's one of the motives for them to keep that area. But the people in the camps, that's the only fish out of a can that they can taste. But all of their relatives had, you know, deep traditions, and their myths, their stories are all about the lushness of their land and being able to fish it. So in the camps, besides like the basic rice and sugar and potatoes and that said apples, but you know, you never know what you're going to get. The meat that you get is chicken and goat. You can only have goat. Every family has a couple of goats outside. Well, some don't, but that's very sad. But because there is a social hierarchy even inside the camps, which I had no idea. But they have this one goat, and they feed it the scraps of their meals, and they can only eat goat if it's a ceremonial, for a ceremony. So there were two artists that were dating when I was there, and they just were like, come on, get married so we can kill a goat and have a big party. But they didn't get married. So I didn't taste goat. There is a chicken farm outside. And this is camel, okay? I went to the women's cooperative, and they were hacking up camel. I thought, God, wow. It's very different than our experience here. And with camels, because they're a nomadic culture, there are camels, but they're eating them instead of using their milk. And, they do drink the milk too, but, I mean, they didn't used to kill them and eat them, but they have to do that in order to survive. So what they do is one camel can feed many, many people, a whole community. And so in the morning, when it's very early in the morning, you'll hear, which is a camel having his throat slit. And so that's what, instead of a rooster, that's what you get in the camps, your alarm clock. And then there are some stores, and basically the people in the military, they do get paid. The men are away in training, but they get paid. And so mostly men have these stores in the center of the camps, and they get the food from Algeria. They buy it. This is just some more stores. This is a picture of the women waiting for gas. They're not looking at me, you can tell. And they use gas for cooking. And so this is just a different kinds of ovens that you have. This would be a house that doesn't have as fancy appliances as this house. But you see, they still feed the gas through the wall. It's still fired by gas. And that was her kitchen, and she's very super proud because her husband was the mayor of one of the neighborhoods in the refugee camps. And so her kitchen is super special. And that was another kitchen that I just walked by and I took the picture. So you can see, you know, it's immaculately clean, and there's a lot of just using whatever you have, but using it in this way where, you know, you're trying to create a sense of order and dignity and beauty in a place that really doesn't only have sand. In order to get into the kitchens, the very first thing you do when you go and you have a meal, or when I walked into a house and was trying to tell the women about my project, is you sit and you have this very long, long tea ceremony. And the tea ceremony, it happens three times. We just did it once, but when you pour the tea, the first pour, you put them all on the tray, and then people drink it, and it's bitter because it's just being mixed. So that's bitter as life. And the next one is the perfect one, and it's sweet as love. And the last one's lost some of its taste, so it's soft as death. And that's the poem that they say. And while they're doing all the pouring, I'm sitting around with lots of women, and they're asking me, why are you doing this? What do you want to do about it, or with your project for us? And, you know, you can imagine they've been there 38 years. People are coming and going from all different countries, and yet they're still there. And so they have the right to ask those kinds of questions. And I just wanted to point out that she was a very good pourer. And the higher you can pour into your glass without dropping a drop, then the more famous you become. And the thing is, that's just made up in the camps, because of there's so much time and it's so hot that you've got to think of ways to fill your life with beauty. So that's one of the things. Every house, somebody can pour it a little bit higher and a little bit neater. So these are the women while I'm having tea, and they're writing down, they're discussing with me, and then they let me into the kitchen, and there I am in a kitchen with Sulaka, making something. And this is Mahayer, who is making the couscous. That's in her kitchen. So you can see this is not such a beautiful state-of-the-art kitchen. But she actually is exactly my age. And she told me that when she was 13 or 14, I think, when I was in 10th grade, that's when the bombs were dropping. And so she was cut off from her family because she was visiting with friends. And so she, just all the friends, you know, grabbed each other's hands and they made their way across the desert. And now what you find is that everybody's adopted all these different people because of the situation there. And there's all different colored people in one family. And that is something that is, you know, that you do see in Manhattan in the center of our lives, but it's not the norm in the rest of America, and it is the norm in the camps. So this is Mahayer making couscous, and one really interesting thing to think is, okay, what are you going to take with you if you can only take one thing? Well, some people got their passports and their identity cards, which was really smart thinking. I certainly wouldn't have thought of that, but it helps them a lot. And she grabbed these three sifters, which was from her grandmother. And each sifter has a smaller opening in the sieve. In the mesh. And so she takes flour and just keeps with her daughter. They keep sifting it through and through. And whatever's left on top is the couscous that we can buy in a bottle and make in 3 minutes. There I am. This is in the liberated territory. I went with Mahela, and we went out to make bread in the sand. Every day in the camps, the women make a loaf of bread, and it's called lochbis. And they make it, and then in my house, the mother had a bad arm, so her neighbor came over in the morning and made a loaf for her and a loaf for Galia. And that's just the way it is. And here, we were making bread in the sand, which is old. It's a traditional nomadic, and also many other cultures, like the story of the Jews and matzah. And so we started that, and it was just the two of us. And then all of a sudden, these people just started arriving out of nowhere, going, "No, no, you're making it wrong. You've got to do it this way. You've got to do it that way." And so as we were making it, it started getting nighttime. I mean, it was taking a long time, as everything does in the desert. And by the end, we're all sitting around in this circle eating this bread that we had just cooked in the sand. And just in case you want to know how to do it, you just don't put yeast in it, and then it doesn't stick to the sand. Okay, and that's nighttime. I don't know. Can you see that? Well, it's just all of us sitting around under the stars of this beautiful night, this wide open sky, and sitting there telling stories around a fire and passing this loaf of bread around. And so from all of that, I put together the cookbook, which is it's in Spanish and in English, and it's in Spanish so that it can go back to the camps and be used by the people and understood by the people who are in it. And this is one of the pages. There's the humanitarian drop and the peas and a collage that I made. And this is about all the women being hostesses and inviting you into their house in order for them to use hospitality as a way of telling you about who they are as a connection. And this man, Saleh, he just said a beautiful thing, which is that when the Moroccans, they eat alone. The Moroccans eat alone at their table. But when we have independence, we'll invite them to sit at the table and eat with us. And that's the way they think. I mean, there's just not anger. It's actually not Morocco, every Moroccan who is doing this to these people. It's the kingdom of Morocco. And that's, you know, that's a very important thing to know. The people in Morocco, a lot of them don't have the greatest lives either, the ones living in the what we call the occupied territory. But if they speak out against what happened to the people from Western Sahara, they get put in jail. And the people who are living in the occupied territory who are Western Saharan, they have no human rights mandate from the UN. So if all of their peaceful demonstrations, the police just come and take them and torture them and disappear them. And in the back of my jacket is four of the disappeared. And every single person who is martyred is commemorated through images, and everybody knows their name. There are many, many songs about them. And that's how they keep their history alive. This was one, it's kind of a cool one. It's I went into a house, and nobody has medicine, right? There was this woman, and she was like, she came out with a jar full of leaves, all these, and it was the leaves of 100 trees, and it would make you, you know, it could heal anything, any ailment. And I thought right away, oh my God, it was like one tree I can see forever and ever and ever. How does she know 100 trees? But it's just a different sensibility. These are all the names that she just rattled off, and I got those down. And, you know, I can look at something and just see nothing, and she can look at it and see it's just, you know, full and teeming with life and nourishment, this desert landscape. So in 2009, I came back with one prototype for the cookbook, and I took it to NGOs, and I tried to get it published there instead of to the art community, because I thought, this is, you know, that's, it really should go in a different venue. And all the NGOs that I went to said, oh, this is great. I mean, this would be no money to help you publish it, but we can't, because Western Sahara is not on our list. So I had to go to an anarchist press in Williamsburg in order to get it published, and long live the anarchists. And so I got it printed, and then the next year, my partner Kirby, he went. I couldn't go because we have kids, so he went, and he delivered, and he didn't take any clothes with him. He just took two bags filled with books and delivered it to all the people. It's now in the main school where they teach English, and I got to go in there and see everybody reading it in 2011 and looking at the pictures of themselves. And this is my mom, Hija Pio, in Camp 27, and looking at her own image. And that was Kirby's mom. That's Hamdi looking in his book. And then back in America, that's Peter Lamborn Wilson, who is a part, he's a partner at Autonomedia. He's a part of the collective. And his name is also Hakim Bey, and he's a North African scholar and a poet, and he studies myths of all different cultures. He got a hold of the cookbook, and this Jim Fleming actually took this photo. And that's Peter reading it, and Diane DePrima, who's a poet. And Peter, who believes in his dreams, after reading it, fell asleep and dreamt that women were cooking couscous in Kassel, Germany. And it was because the next day he had a meeting where he was supposed to meet the director of Documenta, which is a big show that happens every 5 years and in Kassel, Germany, and a million people come. And he said, I'm not going to fly. You should invite this woman, Robin Kahn, who's made a cookbook in solidarity with the women of Western Sahara. And then he calls me up on the telephone, and he leaves a message, and it's like, this is Peter Lamborn Wilson. I'm like, yeah, right. And then, would you like to be in Documenta? If you're interested in this phone call me back. And don't leave a message, because I don't have an answering machine. Click. And so yes was the answer to that. And I had about 2 years to work on bringing the women from Western Sahara and bringing a project to Germany that was about, based on the way that women use the meal and create a sense of home, a sense of security to a people who are homeless. And they create the most inviting houses. This is back in the camps where I went to the women's co-op and told them that we were going to do a project, and they're building the tent that ended up at Documenta. But you can see that all the houses on the outside, they look exactly the same. I mean, you can get lost so easily in the camps because everything looks like that. But when you go into each house is filled with its own color scheme, its own fabrics and pillows, mattresses, and everybody sleeps in the same room where they eat, but each thing is a very separate activity. So everything gets rolled up and put aside for your next activity. And when I was there, I slept with the families in those rooms and prepared meals and then ate with everybody. And the door was always open. If anybody walked by, it was like, hey, we're having a meal, come on in. And then music and poetry. And you could take a nap in the middle of the meal if you were tired, no problem. Then just get up and it's like, ooh, I feel much better. I actually had an experience where they said to me, would you like to take a shower? And I was like, why? Am I smelly? You know, what's that? You know, because you would never say that in a house in New York. You do, hi, welcome for dinner. Would you like to take a shower? So I was like, okay. So then I go in the bathroom, and there's no running water, but there's a bucket that's filled with fresh water. And so I take off my clothes, and I take the bucket and pour it over my head, and it's like, ooh, they boiled the water for me. Wow. No, they didn't boil the water for me. It's 120 degrees. The water got that way from being there. But the thing is, during the meal, because it lasts so long, you just take these showers, come out, put your clothes back on, you feel totally refreshed, you eat the next course, and it's fine. And that's, you know, that's super civilized, really, if you think about it. Let me see. Okay, so I love this. They were building the tent for Documenta, and they had to hang up their clothes, so they just put it down on the ground. That's the inside of the tent. And that's the tent up in the camps. This is what the interior looks like, and the women from the co-op. And here they are. Oops, sorry. Here they are in their glory, the sisters of the tent cooperative. And they rolled up the tent, and because they're a nomadic culture, everything rolls up, everything's portable, and it arrived at Documenta, and it was out in the park. There's some projects that are in a museum or a series of museums, and then there are some that are very site-specific, and I just got this beautiful site that as you walk down the stairs from the museum to go from one to the other, you could see us, and I could say, look, we're just beyond the Pinone tree, which is like a tree with a rock in it. So it was a good landmark for me. And these are my women arriving. And when they arrived, I didn't know the women that I'd be working with at Documenta. I believed in the spirit that they had transpired to me when I was in the camps that they would understand this project. So it was a huge leap of faith. And I worked a long time with Algeria and with the refugee camps and then with Germany administration and then with Spain, just trying to get these women there so that they could be a part of the project. And this is the first day that they arrived, and we just had this great meal because it took us 2 weeks to install the piece. That's Fatma Ghalia. I love her. She's next to me. I love them all, but... So the thing is, at Documenta, you're not allowed to tell who the artists are until the opening. So I didn't know who else would be in it. Nobody else knew. And we went into the cafeteria where you could get free food for the first 2 weeks. And I brought all the women, and they were just like wearing these psychedelic colored melphas. And they're walking in there, and all the artists are wearing black, and they're like skulking around like this, you know? And then these women were like... chatting and having the best time and taking all this cake and sitting around. And so, in a way, the project just announced themselves because people were like, oh, okay, who are these women? Like, these Arabic women, they're acting so free. What are they, artists? So it was great. So it was already, people were talking about it. And the thing I had to say, you have to invite 8 women because men are not allowed to put the tents up. Only women can put the tents up. So here's Fatma Ghalia getting in the middle, and you know they're starting to put the tent up. The only thing I didn't know was that everyone thinks they can do it better than the next woman. And so there was a lot of like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da going on all day. And so, you know, there I am. I'm just trying to like negotiate. Okay, let's just get it vertical, guys, okay? And there we all are working on it. And I had friends from Sevilla come, and my family came, and it takes a village to make a village. And just painting the top. We had to make that rainproofing out of garbage bags and sew it because they told me they would have rainproofing, but it wasn't ready for the opening. So that was Chaya. They're like, no problem. We'll just sew it, no problem. I mean, it was incredible, I have to say. I was having a nervous breakdown, but they were like, no problem. There's Fatma. Okay, so we all went up to lunch, and we had our everything for our installation. And so someone had to stay and make sure, so Fatma just took a nap. So awesome. Okay, and then the other part was a series of walls that was the entrance that you would walk into and see these large collages that I had made so you could read about why this woman from New York is representing something about Western Sahara. So it tells about me going to the art festival and making the cookbook. And then there's Mahayar. There it says who the people are, and these are all people I know, and then where the country is. It tells about the wall and the war, and that's a real photo of the women when they were escaping across the desert. It's, you know, a journalist photo, and those are the kids walking barefoot, and that's what they took with them. And this is about the food. Oh, sorry, and the very last one is about really the art of Sahrawi cooking, what it is, you know, that hospitality is this weapon that happens in the meal, this peaceful way of communicating and making a very invisible people very visible. And so after you read all that, after you read all that, you go in, and then you read the whole thing, and then you take off your shoes, and you go in the garbage bag tent, and you get some couscous, and then you sit down with women of Western Sahara and have a conversation with them around the meal about who they are and why they're there. And it became this really engaging, cacophonic, comfortable environment that, you know, people just wanted to go and hang out. Because why? Because you know, you can either go look at art on a white wall and try to figure out what's going down, or you can go hang out in the tent. So a lot of people hung out there. It was nice. This is just some images from it. That's beautiful Oria. And, you know, there was tea ceremonies going on. There was music playing. There was incense. And this is exactly the way it looks inside each tent, inside each family compound, inside the refugee camps. And it's exactly the way it feels, too. Chaya started making henna tattoo, you know, henna drawings on people. There was dancing all of a sudden. You know, one song would come on and it was like, ah! And everyone's going, and, you know, dancing, and nothing is scheduled. It's very beautiful. It's like very spontaneous. And the thing about Documenta is that everything has, oh my God, there were like all these big fat books with schedules in them. I mean, I couldn't figure my way around that, but I never knew what was going on, but people would tell me, and that was helpful. But whenever stuff was going on in the tent, there's always somebody who's visiting, like looking in one of the books, like, what is this? What is this? What's going on? It was just like, you know what? Just sit down and, you know, join us. And they cover their faces when they get really into dance. And that was a weird thing. Like, what's going on? They do that because they want to turn inside themselves. And then they start writhing so sexy. You can't even believe what parts of their melpha are moving in this provocative way where you can totally see their bodies. And it's, you know, they just want to turn inside. And it's very beautiful. And like an example, Fatma Galia, she had five husbands, okay? Because they have divorced there. Of course they have divorced. If a man's not going to treat you well, then you go get another man. You know, that's just it. So, I learned a lot from these women. Definitely. But I actually like my partner, so that's not one thing. But it's just, you know, their sense of entitlement that they're alive and to make every minute count, because they could be dead tomorrow. And it's that, so the meal is so beautiful, the music is saturated with heart, and, you know, the sounds of suffering and hope for the future. And the clothes are every day, they also all share their melphas. So like one day, you know, Oria's wearing one, the next day Hizana's wearing it, you know, why not? And then you feel completely different, whatever color you're wearing. And we all started doing it too, because every time that I was in the camps and I'd go to a new family, after they got to know me, they would give me a present of a melpha. And one time they even gave me one of a wedding melpha, and then they got this artist who was from the camps, and I was like, Madi, I'll marry you. And we had a fake wedding and everything. And then the next morning, Madi was like horrified, and he kept running away every time. I'm like, Madi, like I'm his wife from New York, right? And he would run away, and because he was terrorized by the fact that we had this beautiful ceremony. But everybody knew it wasn't real. And then I went back in 2011. He was much mellower. He's like, oh, my wife, it's cool. But it was just like, took him a while. And so what we did is, yeah, we had a fashion show just like we did in the refugee camps. And these are the people, those two guys are the people that built that structure that held the billboards. Then there are the women there, their friends are in it. My daughter's back there. And, you know, the music is amazing. It was out on the lawn. And there's beautiful Sally and all our friends just celebrating after. That's the whole group at Documenta at the beginning. And after the women went back, I had to generate a sense of energy that really passed on the message of what these women are about and who these people are. And so the word kind of got out, and we had people who had either been born in Western Sahara in the occupied territory or the liberated territory, who were students in Germany. They would come and just hang out in the tent and talk. We showed movies. Javier Bardem, unbelievably, but in 2010 they had a film festival in the camps, and he went, and he's just made a movie called Sons of the Clouds, which is on Netflix, and so you can get it for free. And it's the story of the people. And he gave it me the movie for free just to show it there, a documenta. The people who were helping me in the tent were PhD students from Ireland, and I had bought way too many potatoes for couscous, and the women were like, we don't use potatoes in our couscous. And so I was like, what am I going to do with these? And then Dave said, I know how to make potato soup. I'm from Ireland. And so he made potato soup, and then everybody ate that. And then the next day, somebody came down from another installation, and they said, I'll make, bolognese sauce, and we can all have that. And so we started this whole tradition that, after the tent was closed, and it was in the evening, this whole cookbook that's, ancillary to the project has transpired with all the people who were there hanging out for 3.5 months using the tent and the space to cook and tell other people about who they are through their food. So that was very cool. And this is the Minister of Culture. So they have a Minister of Culture in the refugee camps. Who would think that? I certainly wouldn't have thought that. Well, yeah, because she understands the power of art to transcend, barriers and among people. And this is Issa Sam, the man with the white scarf. And he's from Senegal. He's a very famous artist in Senegal. He's a shaman and an artist. And he had an installation across the park where it was all kind of voodoo stuff hanging down from the trees. He came to pay homage to the Minister of Culture and have tea with her in the tent. And then he left the tent, went back to his installation, and brought the flag of Senegal to her. She just stood up, like, right away and took the Polisario flag, which is the government in exile's flag, and tied it together with his flag. Then all the women saw that. They came running out and going, bah! And dancing and singing. And then the Minister of Culture started speaking in French about the power of art to as a peaceful weapon. And it was beautiful. And then 3 days later, I got a phone call. I was in the tent, and it was in French, and it was, Robin, est-ce que tu es là? And then it was the embassy from Senegal that was in Germany. They created a piece of paper that said that Senegal now supports the people of Western Sahara. So I guess art really can, It can bring people together and bring countries together and make people struggle that's so not visible, visible. And that's just the last slide. That's the whole team that made it, put it all up. And that's my daughter in green, and that's me in yellow there. And, oh, there's Kirby right there. And that's it. So now you know about the people of Western Sahara. I'm actually going to go back there in 2 weeks and to Algiers. They invited me to participate in a demonstration of women in peaceful resistance, and from an international one. So I'm very excited about that. And then I got this whole installation, because it can just roll up into a ball, because that's the way they do it. I got it back in America, and in Dallas in October, there's going to be this, I guess it's a 4-city big festival run by this not-for-profit organization called MAP, which is Making Art with Purpose, and we're going to have a tent in the park right across from the Dallas Museum of Art. So as a way, I don't know what will be happening in there and who will be doing it with me from the camps, but we'll introduce what we've learned together to the desert in Texas. But actually, somebody said to me, it's not the desert. Dallas isn't the desert. I don't really know. I haven't been there yet. But at least it won't rain all the time, which it did in Castle. And these women had never seen so much rain, but neither had I. I mean, the third day, the tent started to travel down the front lawn, and we were holding it up with brooms. And everybody is coming to the tent. Why? Because they're all out in the park, and it's the only place that has shelter. And so they're like, this is cool, and can we have more tea? And we're like, yeah, no problem, but we're holding it up. But as it transpired, actually, I did get a really good rain protection from Documenta, which we then put and took off the garbage bags. and it looked a lot better, and it actually worked really well. But it rains a lot there. I mean, torrentially, and otherwise it's a very beautiful town. And I don't know, I'll just finish, and if you have questions, and... Oh, yeah, right. Oh, and I have this booklet that is, when I met Peter Lambourne Wilson, I said, nobody's going to believe that you had this dream, Peter. I mean, you need to write it down and send it to me in a letter. So the first page of this booklet is the letter that Peter sent to me, and he typed it out on his old, not electric typewriter, because he doesn't have anything that was invented past 1911. Okay? 1911, that's the year. And then it's my letter back to him about my experience in the camps. And then Mick Taussig, who's an anthropologist and a friend of mine, he also helped push get the project there. So it's actually an email he sent me, but it's so beautiful and poetic. And then Federico Guzman's the last letter in it. And he's my artist friend up there with the orange thing and the red hair from Spain. And he is the one who went to Arte Ferite the year before I did. And he showed me his pictures when I said, wait a minute, where is this place? Who are these people? And that's how the whole cookbook came about. So it's I designed this, and we made it for Documenta, and they gave it out for free. And it's a nice keepsake of the experience. So everybody, when you have time, just read it. It's for you. Because everything's free in the camps.
I think we should take some questions.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I did a lot of, like, talking. Yeah. I don't know. Has anyone heard of Western Sahara before this? Yeah?
I work with a nonprofit that works with on Matthew Hagar.
Oh, yeah. Wow. What's it called?
The Robert F. Kennedy Center.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, it's the Kennedy
Oh,
Kennedy
yeah, Center. Yeah. I've met Marcella and Mina, who came. We had a dinner at her house. She is a woman who was imprisoned for 4 years because she was a peaceful demonstrator against what was happening. She lived in the occupied territory. And she was, I think, a teenager, right? When they grabbed her out of her house at night. They disappeared her for 4 years. Her family wasn't able to ask where she was, but while she was in jail, they blindfolded her for 4 years.
Yeah.
And now she's out, and she's sort of the Sahrawi Gandhi. She goes around and wants a peaceful resolution to the situation. And the thing is, in the camps, the kids who were born there and never seen their land, they want to take up arms at this point, because, you know, there's nothing happening. And she is the one, you know, one trying to push this through other means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought this was great that it's so few people know about the issue. This was a really good introduction to
good. Thank you.
What's going on.
Yeah.
I'm curious about, like, the dietary laws. Like, what is the main influence? Is it halal, or is it the Spanish culture?
It's a little mix of everything.
So are they following, like, classic, like, halal cooking with the cut, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's why they do the camel. Certain people know how to cut the camel. There's a women's cooperative now that's teaching women how to butcher, so that they can have the delis and everything, and they can have the meat stores instead of the men. It's so cool, right? Yeah. I mean, does that answer it?
Yeah. Just kind of...
Yeah, I mean, there is... You know what? During colonial times, they intermixed with the Spanish, and so there's tons of different kinds, you know, mixtures of cultures there in terms of the food, in terms of the people, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
I was wondering if you had had conversations with them about how they felt kind of being transported or displaced again in Kosovo.
They loved it. I was so nervous because I was being their hostess, really. You know, it was a reversal. And they were like, Robin, this is so great. And you know what? All of them want the opportunity to tell their story. All of them. And when they learned, like the first day, I'm telling them this is what's going down, and they were just like, sister, welcome, you know, and they had a lot of fun there. We were in an apartment. We had to shop for the food every day, and they took me to the Turkish area, and we became friends with everybody there, and it was, you know, they could teach me a lot, and I could expose them to this whole other kind of a world. And so, I mean,
there's
I think it's the whole world. I think every culture has it. I mean, I sort of went in with this very open, you know, not an understanding, you know, just seeing what I was surprised by the fact that some people had more than others. I really was. I mean, there's also, you know, there are other things that I saw that are so similar to our culture. I mean, there is, I mean, even the men, there is sexism. Like, they're like, don't you think the women have a little too much power? Like that to me. I'm like, no, I don't think so, you know? But you know, it's still the same conversation, you know, in every culture. It doesn't matter if it's created artificially. You still, I guess we still have that same way of creating communities, you know, thinking I'm better than you, whatever, you know? Well, they make the tents. And the clothes, they get the fabric from Mauritania.
Oh, okay.
And my tent, the fabric came from China. Because this woman walked in, I had no idea of that either. Because they have all these beautiful fabrics. But, you know, they come through different means to them. And this woman was like, this is from China. I'm like, really? And then it was like made in China, like one of those. But, no, they sew the whole thing, you know. And they make all the clothes, they make all the pillows, the rugs that they have, some of them are from China, you know, they're kind of what we would call oriental rugs, or whatever, you know, but they're kind of fake, they're polyester, and, but everything just looks so great, you know, until you dissect it that way, and I can't answer a lot of questions, you know, because I don't know really where they got those exact fabrics, but I know that the fabric from Mauritania is the coolest because that's all hand tie-dye, so it's like it's so beautiful. And they pick different fabrics for different reasons for wearing them. You know, there's when all the women get together in before a presentation or something, they wear a certain kind of nafa. And you know, when they're just hanging out at home, the women take their nafas off. And I saw this scene where there was a television and it had Beyonce. At, like, and she was singing, put a ring on it, right, like this, like wearing nothing. And then all these girls had come home from school and they, you know, were dancing around provocative. They all wear American, you know, or what we call Western clothes, you know, underneath their malfas. Except for some of the women my age, they wear nothing under their malfas because it's so hot and it's really free. And believe me, when you're in the desert, that's the way you want to go. Definitely. I mean, I saw what that was about. Yeah. But, oh, yeah, so I'm cooking in the kitchen, and then, you know, with these women wearing their malfas, and then these girls are dancing, and then in the very back, I can see Beyonce, like, with no clothes, you know, in a bikini, going, oh, and it was just like, what a clash of, you know, visual cultures, and, you know, it's just like, wow, they could see this back home, you know. Yeah. All these are from like little telephone. Yeah, we all took them.
I was wanting to see more because when the way you described the inside of, you know, of the tent.
Yeah.
I was wishing I could see that, you know.
You know what they said? 45 minutes. I don't know how long I've spoken. I don't know how much time. So
right,
I had like this really long thing, and the last few days I've just been chopping it up, like,
yes,
you know, trying to make a diet for it. Like put it on a diet.
But you were allowed to take
photos. Yeah. And I mean, the Swedish TV came and they said, look, we want to film inside because Sweden has been very supportive of the people of Western Sahara. And you know, German TV was there. It was really great. And I didn't speak for the women, they spoke for themselves. So, yeah, they were very open about that. And I think that was one of the themes of Documenta was, you know, grassroots solutions. Creative solutions or something that are alternative. I'm speaking for the director. I'm not even sure exactly, but it was a pretty cool exhibition, actually. Yeah.
Well, it wasn't clear to me. Is the cookbook available anywhere?
Yeah, I don't know. It's not available upstairs, I doubt. Autonomy Media, yes. And I mean, on the back of this yellow thing here, it says robincon.blogspot.com. That's me, and I don't have a website. I will get one really soon. And there's a reason that I do really well in refugee camps, because websites, I don't know. But anyway, this is all, if you go on there, you can download the cookbook for free. It tells you how. Or it's $15, and you know, you can do, I can send it to Artana Media and
Amazon.
Yeah, oh, Amazon, right.
I should leave with that.
It's time. Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening.